good evening and welcome. Tonight's event is part of the program in relation to the exhibition Spectral White, the appearance of colonial era Europeans in the small exhibition hall that is curated by Anna Bruce, who unfortunately fell sick and is not with us tonight, and myself, Anselm Franke, the working at the house as head of the Department for Visual Arts and Film. I'm really glad that our speakers, Rajkamal Kalon, Kalpana Seshadri, and Erhard Schüttpelz, agreed to dive deeper into some of the issues and problematics that this exhibition raises. My introduction will be very short. I just wanted to mark a few points, and in the discussions after the talks, we'll hopefully be able to sharpen some of the questions raised by this exhibition and its legacy. So just a few words now. I mean, it's Julius Lipp's project on which this exhibition is based was a kind of early ethnographic attempt. Then he was the director of an ethnological museum, the Jotenstrauch-Rust-Museum in Cologne, that still exists today, which he left basically escaping from the Nazi regime in 1934 into exile in the United States, where he basically published a book called The Savage Hits Back, The White the White Man Through Native Eyes, published in English in 1937, in German later, Der Wilde schlägt zurück. And this book is based on a collection that he had formed as the director of the museum with the assistance of his team and others through the 1920s. And this is one of the earliest known attempts within the discipline of ethnography, ethnology, anthropology, at reversing the gaze by collecting depictions of Europeans and looking back at the white man, at Europeans. The goal of this exhibition, though, was not to celebrate Lipps as a pioneer of any sorts, in the sense of the ethnographic autocritique and his explicit anti-racist goals. Lipps was that, but it's also far more complicated. So he was, to a certain degree, a pioneer within his discipline, within Europe, and he definitely carved out a space that the overwhelming majority of his discipline directed at, as the gaze was at the colonial other and involved as it was in othering and racializing. But it's also a lot more complicated. What appears as an advanced and progressive stance upon closer reading, and I think the exhibition makes that hopefully clear enough, turns out to be at best ambivalent and at worst overtly racist itself. But what these exhibits, these collectibles that we staged, that we brought together partially from the very collection Lipps had formed here, by staging it today, by making it available to audiences today, might help producing, and this was our hope, is to create a kind of structural awareness of the implications of the gaze and the need for a double consciousness when it comes to ethnographic representations and the attempt to undo the unilateral gaze. And this notion of a double consciousness obviously is borrowed from the Black radical tradition, first coined by W.E.B. Du Bois in the earliest 20th century. A double consciousness that I speak of here would have to complement that kind of double consciousness that Du Bois to Fanon in the Black Radical tradition speak of, or speak of in related but not identical concepts, as the one that is inflicted by the white gaze. No? And I'm not going to go into detail, but the title of this exhibition was meant to also mark that field of problems. And today we are listening to presentations that in their very own way are going to unravel aspects of that under the larger topic of mimicry and white men. This is in quotation marks also because we borrowed this title. It is the title of a opinionated and sharp paper by Ken Kiat Lim, who is analyzing in this paper the discourse that evolved around Jean Rouch's film Les Maîtres Fous, The Mad Masters. Of mimicry and white man introduces the whole problematics of mimicry and the claim towards a reversed gaze. And I just wanted to pay credit or pay my dues to the borrowed title by reading to you one quote that will for now stay a bit up in the air, and hopefully later on as we move gradually towards, closer and closer towards a discussion of Les Maîtres Fous by Jean Rouch and the other film Jaguar by Jean Rouch that we're going to show from 9 o'clock on. And this sentence is basically the following, quote, "The gaze internal to the white man, brackets structural to the subjectivity, as a gaze would be, has been unexpectedly hijacked by the native's alleged mimicry, being misrecognized now as the reverse gaze. That is to say, if the reverse gaze exists at all, it must first do so within the white man's identity, only that it is later hijacked as the reverse," unquote. I just wanted to mark this as, you know, to sort of hint towards the problematics of the claim of a reversed gaze, which all of the discussions within the ethnological discourse are often and should be referring back to Lips. In terms of the a few kind of practical things about the evening, we're going to listen to these three speakers, the three lectures. We have, depending on the time that the lecture itself takes, time for common discussion. And then we're going to quickly change the setup for the screening itself, during which I would encourage you, should you intend to stay for the screenings, to get a drink, because the bar unfortunately closes at 9. So when the screening will start, and you will be allowed to take white wine and water into the screening room. After that, the bar will be closed, so it will be dry. Thanks for coming again, and our first speaker is Rashk Kamal Kalon, and she is an artist living in Berlin for quite some years already, who in her work draws on the legacies of colonialism and the aesthetics of colonial archives, and who is going to speak about her own artistic practice, considering forms of political and aesthetic resistance through the writings of, among others, Julius Lips, Bernice Johnson Ragon, and Akil Mbembe. Please welcome Rashk Kamal Kalon.
So I want to start by saying I'm very happy to be here. I appreciate Anselm's invitation to speak with you. I have to start by confessing that I struggled with this, thinking about this talk a bit. And the reason for that is because for someone like myself, who's been working on issues of colonial visuality for the last 20 years, I have almost too much to say about someone like Julius Lips, German colonialism, ethnographic museums, archives, and how we might reimagine the aesthetics of empire. But perhaps the best place to start is with myself. So I was born in the US, I'm an artist, and I've lived in Berlin since 2010. My parents left Punjab, India in 1974 to migrate to the US under a liberalized immigration policy that was directed at the educated classes of the Third World. So you had doctors, lawyers, and teachers leaving their native homes and beginning to populate the fields and the factories of the US, and my parents were among them. So for the past two decades, I have been thinking about history and its traces in the form of archives, and how these serve as important sources of information about our present world, one that is profoundly unequal, genocidal, and on the verge of environmental collapse. The scientist, Donna Haraway, puts it another way when she asks, what does it mean to think, act, and write in an age of extermination and extinction? And what is the work of recuperation? For me, part of the answers lie in a prologue that's written by David Stanner to his book, American Holocaust. I'll paraphrase him. He describes an early summer morning in 1945 when the first atomic bomb was detonated at a military test site named after the Holy Trinity in the deserts of New Mexico. 4.5 centuries earlier, on October 12, 1492, Columbus landed at San Salvador. Both of these moments represented culminations of technological achievement for their countries, and both in their own way set off a level of destruction and devastation never before witnessed in the entire history of the world. 21 days after the test at Trinity, the first atomic bomb was dropped on Hiroshima, killing 130,000 people in one explosion. 21 years after Columbus landed in the Caribbean, the vastly populated island that he renamed Hispaniola was desolate. Nearly 8 million people, those that Columbus called Indians, had been killed by violence, disease, and despair. So Stanner describes that in the frame of one generation, what happened on Hispaniola was the equivalent of 50 Hiroshimas. And this was just the beginning, he writes. I think we often use a term like colonialism too casually, disconnected from past events and firsthand experiences. For me, this term emerges from a lived experience of migration, having lived in the US, Germany, and Italy. This term, the term of colonialism, also emerges from tremendous histories of violence that inform not only my work as an artist, but also informs my understanding of what it means to carry a US passport while I live and work in Europe. So 2 weeks ago, I was traveling between Italy and Germany to have a public discussion with the Viennese artist Liesl Ponger, who has spent much of her career working on inverting the colonial gaze of ethnographic museums And while I was traveling between Florence and Dresden, I stumbled across an interview with Achille Mbembe, and it was titled Thoughts on the Planetary. There were many things that I appreciated about it, in particular that he delineated a kinship between plantation slavery, colonial predation, and contemporary forms of resource extraction and appropriation. He goes further and addresses the shifting role of racism in colonialism, its relationship to genocide, and the increasing production of disposable populations in an age of computational capitalism and algorithms. And then when he goes on and warns against, and I'm quoting him here, sectarian logics of enclosure underpinned by flawed notions of identity, gender, or culture as spaces of protection and immunity, as borders which allow for a closing off from those who are not as radical as us. I was struck by the similarities to another essay I had recently read. And this other essay was written by Dr. Bernice Johnson Reagan, and it was in an essay called Coalition Politics, Turning the Century, and originally appeared in a book called Homegirls, a Black Feminist Anthology, dating from 1983. Achille Mbembe and Dr. Reagan, almost 40 years apart, coming from extremely different intellectual and cultural traditions, say surprisingly similar things. Bernice Johnson Reagan, for those that don't know her, was a founding member of SNCC's Freedom Singers. SNCC is the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and they were integral to the civil rights movement in the U.S. in the 1960s. She's also the founder of the group Sweet Honey in the Rock. She's a musician, an activist, and recently I noted that she refers to herself as a song talker. So she talks song. And so in her essay, she also addresses disposability, technology, and the need to get out of safe spaces and open up to and breathe in the world as our only hope to transform and change things. While Mbembe talks about the notion of responsibility and care that we owe each other, Reagan, in contrast, talks about extremely high costs, both emotional and physical, that must be paid when we try to form coalitions across race, gender, class, religion, or national borders. And yet she insists that this work must be done. So I think it's from this vantage point or worldview of opening up and breathing in the world that also orients me to look at German history, colonialism as a global project, Mbembe would call it a planetary one, and also to reclaim someone like Julius Lips as a potential model of resistance, however flawed, at least to the dominant logic of extermination that was embedded in the colonial practices of his time. So some years ago, I started to think about Lips as a potential anti-fascist, anti-colonial figure who tried very imperfectly to work with humor against the grain of whiteness, against the grain of colonial hubris, and at least attempted to shift the gaze of study and examination onto the European colonizer. All of these qualities are somehow also deeply embedded in my work as an artist, and perhaps, well, it certainly is the reason why I'm interested in somebody like Lips. So my study into colonial visuality and archives has frequently brought me into contact with the disciplines of ethnography and anthropology. In particular, I'm interested in how anthropological portraiture and photography underpins contemporary forms of racial subjectivities. So I'd like to turn now to talk about an exhibition that took place at the Weltmuseum Wien. This is Vienna's oldest ethnographic museum, and it was founded by the Habsburg royal family. I'm just going to take a sip of water. The exhibition took place almost 18 months after my artist-in-residence, which was in the winter of 2016. At the time, the museum was closed to the public. It was closed altogether for 3 years, having a kind of rebirth. It was being renamed. The whole museum and permanent collections were being redesigned. They were attempting to bring in or talk about their history and topics such as colonialism. And part of, I think, this series of gestures of redefining themselves, my residency took place in that time period. And so for the exhibition, for the residency project, and the title of my exhibition, and also what framed my understanding of what it meant for me to walk into this museum, to encounter it and have the museum encounter me, I framed my thinking around this query of Haraway's again. So what does it mean to act in an age of extermination? And she answered her own query by saying, staying with the trouble. And at the time when I was conceiving this, it was 2015, I misquoted her as staying with trouble. And I like my misquotation better. And so the exhibition was, and my residency was titled that. And I was drawn to this idea around the Ethnographic Museum because for me, what the concept represents is about standing in the middle of a contradiction, being pulled in opposing directions, and yet staying within the discomfort to possibly make a new kind of meaning. And so that's, for me, what was at stake in entering a museum like this. But going in, I did have many judgments of what an ethnographic museum is. Chief among them were that they are steeped in a foundational and existential form of colonial violence and are very likely unredeemable. In contemporary ethnographic museums today, you can witness many schizophrenic gestures, a scramble for politically correct language, and a desperate need to be on the right side of history. And yet it's this very desire to be right that which is rooted in a binary philosophical understanding of the world that doesn't allow the museum to understand its complex entanglements in the perpetuation and reproduction of new forms of colonial violence. So for me, walking into an ethnographic museum is like walking into a Holocaust museum that doesn't understand its purpose. It's aided in the destruction of the majority of the world's culture and people, and now celebrates the material evidence of that destruction. And in nearly the same breath, it aims to become now a pro-migrant, multicultural community space supporting the very communities it once helped to defame. So I'd like to begin by talking about the exhibition, which was made up by several different projects, and I'll go through them one by one. I'd like to begin with this project, which is Die Völker der Erde. It's the title is drawn from a 1902 German anthropology book that I purchased from an antiquarian bookseller that was located across the street from the museum, and I would pass each day coming home. And originally, I only had the intention that the book would be a kind of research material for me. It's very typical of books being produced at the time. It also almost is an exact replica or copy of a British book that was published about 5 years earlier, and And yet this, what was supposed to just be research material, somehow became an important project for me and a sort of central anchor to this show that took place. I'll show a few details and talk about. So I will also mention that for me, this form of what it means to cut apart the book is one that I've been working with for some time. I think the first book that I cut apart was in 2001 when I lived in New York City and I was attending the Whitney program, and it was just a few weeks after the attacks on September 11th, which I witnessed from a close distance, where the logic of cutting up the book started first presented itself to me. So for me, what it represents is it's about taking away the cultural authority of the book. It's on the one hand a way to talk back to the book itself, to the author, but in a larger sense for me, it represents a way, this performative act of violence is a way of also talking back to the history of Western knowledge production. And even while I say that, there's this other a range of meaning that I think the gesture also contains, which is that the gesture of an angry teenager who defaces their school books or texts. For me, it encompasses all of those things for me. And so I'll just keep going through and show you some images and talk a bit about the process. The works for me are really quick, they're spontaneous, they are something akin to a kind of stream of consciousness. I really try to not premeditate my, or think about how I'm going to respond. I really try to open up within this project a completely free space where I'm allowed to react in any way that I want to the imagery and try to then understand the meaning afterwards. And often, whatever it is that I'm reading, whether it be in the news or an essay or a conversation I'm having, it's getting filtered into this project. And so it's a way for me to work through a lot of different ideas and a lot of different images very quickly. And the original presentation at the Weltmuseum was about 68 or 69 pages. And I continue to work on this project up until this year. And the last image in this project that I'll show will actually be to show you the completed scale of the project. But I'll take you through some of the images. I think the only frame that I do set for myself with this project is that I want to, in some way, shift the original meaning of the image. So in some way, I want the intervention to change how we can read this book. But the how of that, of what the image is often a surprise to me. Take you through a few more. And then the next image is the one that I mentioned. So it was last shown at for the first time it was shown in its completed form at Mebo Kunsthalle, and it was in an exhibition that was up from April to August of this year. And this project in its entirety will be shown next week at Gallery Wedding. I've been working on a show with Natasha Illich, and we're going to show the 300 works in one of the rooms in a kind of dense installation. And for me, I just wanted to, even though this is not part of the Weltmuseum exhibition, I wanted to kind of show the progress of the work or the evolution of the work, and just say that there's something for me that is important in the symbolism and shift that takes place between the individual drawing and the what becomes a monumentally scaled work. So collectively, the drawings gain a force and a power that they don't have on their own. And so for me, this metaphor or symbolism is an important one. So on the far wall, you see three portraits of women, and this is the next project I wanted to talk about. It also grows out of the book Die Völker der Erde, and it's a project, it's a portrait project of women that I found in Die Völker der Erde, as I mentioned. And as I had said that with that last project, it was really a kind of quick sketch like work, spontaneous. But in the process of doing this work, there were images that spoke to me that I wanted to work with further. And so this project was born out of that. So essentially, especially the first images that I chose were of women, and they were particularly abject and particularly brutal. Sometimes the women didn't have hair, they were unclothed, sometimes the gaze was unfocused. And I don't show those images next to these works, I only show the portraits. And so essentially what the process is what you're looking at are, I found these images, then I scanned them and made new photographic reproductions of them, but enlarged into a kind of standard portrait size. And then I brought these photographic prints back into the studio. And then once there, I started to paint on top of them. And for me, this project is really a kind of personal one. It more than anything, it's about a gesture of care. And it's really about trying to rehabilitate some notion of identity and humanity and beauty of each of the women and give them a very different identity and presence than the book had afforded them. And so these are four images that were included at the Weltmuseum show. And this next image was actually not an original print that I included in the show, but I did produce 2,000 posters for the opening weekend. And that was another thing about this exhibition that was, I've never shown in an ethnographic museum before, but the work really needed to be there somehow. It was really important that it was there. And also there was, because the museum had been closed for 3 years, there was a scale of attention and attendance that I had never before encountered as an artist. So there were something like 7,000 to 9,000 visitors in the opening weekend. And so it was also this more popular encounter with the work. And I'm just going to show a couple of more images because it's an ongoing project. It's one that I actually... I gain a lot of pleasure and joy out of doing, and I even I talk to the women and into the images and try to listen and treat each image individually and listen for what they're asking for. And that's the last image from the series. And so the next project, the next part of the show was actually this travel diary. I'll show you the next image that I created. So part of the frame of my residency, I had proposed to create a contemporary travel diary that is based on this 19th century European form of travel diaries. And so I created a handwritten and annotated with watercolors, a travel book that was in the tradition of lips and in this gesture of reversing the gaze. It was about me kind of entering as the anthropologist or ethnographer into the museum, studying the staff, studying their structures, their institution, and then creating a document that dealt with that. And so here, and the museum, the travel diary belongs to the Weltmuseum, and so they wanted to show it under a vitrine, and next to the vitrine was a digitized copy that the viewers could go through the content. And part of the content is shown here. On the upper image, what you have is a handwritten, transcribed passage of Aimé Césaire's Discourse on Colonialism. And below that, you have two watercolor images. Excuse me. On the right is one made by Otto Finch, who was a German ornithologist and colonial administrator, and who took a trip to the South Pacific. And on the left is my interpretation of his watercolor. And I don't know why, but I think this the top image is somehow a good one for lips. And the bottom sentence, I didn't realize you were so aggressive. So often in this travel diary, what I would include are things that I would overhear or things that were said to me directly while I was in residence, and the kinds of things that I would often hear, sentences that would be said, is like, everyone was racist back then, or we gave them back their skulls and they were very happy. In this case, a curator, I shared in a very candid fashion my really strong emotional responses to looking at the way women were depicted and people were depicted in the photo archive, and the way I wanted to weaponize them. I wanted to give them grenades and guns and different things to hold. And she looked at me very blankly and said, "I didn't know you were so aggressive." And there was silence. And then I laughed and said, "I hope you're kidding." And she didn't answer. And so it went into the book. This is an example of a kind of dialogues that I was thinking about at the time. So for me, both in terms of the website, the public face of the museum, there was a kind of discrepancy about what was being talked about and how it was being talked about. And in particular, I had seen a TED talk by the then current director of the museum, and it was marvelous and shocking how he could talk about such scales of historical devastation and trauma, but make it sound wonderful. And this dissonance between what's being said and how it's being said. So I started to have kind of these private dialogues with the language of the museum. So A represents what was on the website. So the Weltmuseum Wien is a meeting place for peoples and cultures and an institution where respect and interest in cultural diversity are promoted. And then B is my response to them. If you let me dig up your grandmother and put her on display, then we can be friends. Okay, take a sip. And this next project, there's one thing actually I forgot to mention with this book. Just that it relates a bit to Julius Lips, in that a few years ago I wrote a very, very brief grant proposal where I actually talked about doing a close reading of the Savage Hits Back. And somehow in creating a contemporary travel diary where I undertake a survey of German anthropological museums and create a visual record of my responses. And so it was both linking to his work and to this project of travel diaries and as a space to talk about German colonial relationships. And it's a project that hasn't been realized, but I really like this form of the book because it becomes a really discursive space that can really contain a lot of different types of thinking, and I really liked it. I think it's something that I want to work with more. And so I'll go on to the next project. So part of what was nice about working officially with the museum is being able to use these antique vitrines. Actually, the Weltmuseum a few years ago was sort of taken over and is now managed by the Kunsthistorisch Museum. So they get their money and all the decisions that are made for them kind of come through the Kunsthistorisch Museum. And so they have a colonial relationship with this museum, but they also share their things like vitrines, and I was able to get these two vitrines to present a couple of projects. And one of them is called Dear Sir, I Regret to Inform You. And this project, for me, was really about taking, it's a portrait series of scientists and directors associated with the museum. And so it was really about trying to shift the gaze, the lens, our attention, our view onto who produces knowledge rather than who is subjected to that knowledge. And so I created a set of very traditional pencil portraits. This is Christian Schickelgruber, who is the current director. Then he was the vice director, and he's also the curator of South Asia, Himalayas, Nepal, Laos, Vietnam, something like really absurd like this, like a kind of constellation of regions. And for me, the project was really about thinking about how within histories within Europe of how face markings have been seen as a mark of what is primitive. And so there was a desire on my part to try to other these men, these white men associated with the museum, and so this is how this project was born, out of this wish to kind of put them in front of the lens. But as I was doing this project, so this is Rudolf Pock, who is, I guess, best known for the fact that he pioneered the use of film and audio in his fieldwork in anthropology, but also that he studied prisoners of war. So for me, while I was doing this project, I realized that on the one hand, that there was a kind of ethical problem in this project, but I still did it because I need to do the project to understand what it is I'm doing. It's like the meaning comes after I do the work. And the problem for me was in that I was attending to this history of how Europe had defined face markings as being primitive, and I was using it to kind of make these men and these scientists the butt of my joke. But what I didn't attend to is the fact that for many people, for many people, this kind of body marking or face marking is sacred, and so that part was not. This project didn't attend to that, and it was something that disturbed me. But I continued, I made the project and presented it. And here you have who was the then director and whose TED talk I had seen, Steven Engelman, who's now retired. And so I, just to say that when I presented the works, practically nobody said, no one said anything in particular about this other than laughing. But at the opening, this is Otto Finch, so the watercolor that I referenced in the travel diary. But at the opening of the show at the Weltmuseum, there was somebody who was there, Wayne Modest, who I respect a great deal and have been working with recently. He's the director of the Research Center for Material Culture, and he's basically been working in the forefront of ethnographic museums and really anything progressive that's happening in the field. He's been sort of in the front of it. And he sort of said to me, has anyone been critical about this project or said anything critical? And almost like I was confessing, I was like, no, but they could. And then he knew exactly, without me having to say more, because there was this arbitrariness. I had sort of made up these markings. And he suggested that if I continue with the project, which I will when I have more time, but that there was a way. He asked me, what about if you connected the facial markings or the tattoos to the regions that the specific anthropologist studied? And for me, that made a kind of sense where the project, I could continue that project with that parameter because it then loops that historical meaning and it's not arbitrary. And so just that. And so that's this project. This is the first director of the Weltmuseum. His name was Fritz Rock. He is alleged to have been a member of the Nazi Party before it was even legal in Austria. He was definitely making exhibitions that were sympathetic to Aryan ideology. And so that's the last portrait in that series. And then the second and last vitrine from the exhibition contained a set of watercolors that I made. And so you can see the kind of intimate scale or size here. And all of these watercolors are made in response to and quote images from the Weltmuseum's photo archive. So in addition to working on books and painting on top of photographs, I'm also very interested in how painting provides a third space for me to think about photography without its trace actually being there. And so in a lot of these images, essentially I'm quoting a photographic subject from the archive, but then adding a kind of alteration that can be, I guess, characterized as surreal, sometimes funny, sometimes disturbing. And I'll take you through a few of these. So this is the last, excuse me, I keep hitting this. This is the last image I'm gonna put up. So I didn't understand it at the time, but I realize now that the exhibition I made for the museum was a love letter. At the end of my residency, I could have just left a few traces about what it meant to be there. This was all that was contractually expected of me after a two-month residency. But the people I found trapped inside the Weltmuseum's photo archive kept calling me closer, asking me to speak with them, asking for a way out. The need to care for, rehabilitate, and transform the traces of people and cultures that have for so long been distorted, maligned, and erased by institutions like the Weltmuseum was too powerful to refuse. I couldn't turn away. During the next 18 months, with my contract to the museum already fulfilled, I crafted what I now think of as a love letter to the men and the women who are still in that archive, and ultimately to the museum itself. Making this work something akin to what Shimembe refers to as each of us owing a debt of care and responsibility to others and to the biosphere. So in conclusion, I want to paraphrase some of Shimembe's ideas to point again at Julius Lips. Shimembe and many others before him, I saw Hannah Arendt's book, but have noted that colonialism always contains within it a genocidal potential. Where there is racism, being in the world is the same as being against others. The other is treated as an existential threat which must be defended at all cost. I think it's some of this ground built under the ideas of racial superiority and genocide that a work like The Savage Hits Back or The White Man Through Native Eyes starts to question. Though patronizing and flawed, in the same breath, it is also anti-authoritarian and anti-fascist. So following Lip's gesture that he began but somehow couldn't bring himself to continue in The White Man Through Native Eyes, I want to end with a trace of those, of one of those that were left who survived what David Stannard terms the post-Columbus or the post-Columbian Holocaust. It's a Mayan passage that comes from a Mayan text called Chilambalam, and it refers to what the white lords did to our land. So, they taught fear and they withered the flowers so that their flower should live. They maimed and destroyed the flower of others. Marauders by day, offenders by night, murderers of the world. Thank you.
We do not have so much time, but we'll take a few minutes, definitely, also depending on how many questions you might have. First, thanks a lot for sharing your thoughts with us and for these powerful, stunning images, really. I don't want to force you into this frame of discussing mimesis and mimicry, but I was just wondering whether or what comes up in your mind when you have when I ask you about the relationship between the facial, the acts of defacement, refacement, the facial markings, the facial tattoos versus the clothing. Because the clothing is also something that is so important in the exhibition over there as a kind of marker through which one can identify who might actually be, signified. And also because of the amazing attention to the meticulous detail that is sometimes reproduced, whereas other things are, interpreted in in ways that might not always be accessible in their meaning. So I was just wondering about whether you could share your thoughts about this relation, because most of the clothes are also like the political symbols of the contemporary references you insert. They are distinctively different and sort of a modern category, whereas what you do to the faces is sort of the opposite direction.
That's true. I didn't think of that. I think for me, not to just make light of it too much, the women for me, I mean, I really love clothes and fashion, and there is a special pleasure in finding something like a chic hairstyle. I'm looking at and certain kinds of clothes. And it's true, I'm destabilizing this idea, because often as a person of color, you are always thrown back into being a historical subject. You're never modern. And even this colonial encounter was always this wish, I think, from Europe to see the pure and untouched native, rather than understanding that there was a two-way crossover going on. And so I think with these women, who the book attempts to situate them as being primitive subjects that a European audience would look at and see as such, I'm trying to destabilize that. And so then I bring them into kind of our milieu. And then I think with people like Steven Inkelman or Christian Schickelgruber, the directors of the Weltmuseum and the scientists, it's really, it's not that the world has situated them as primitive. The world has situated them as authority figures. And even now within the Weltmuseum, what's interesting to look at is that it's white men who manage and have the highest salaries in the museum. The workforce of the museum, though largely white, is female. They're highly skilled workforce with temporary contracts. And so you have like this kind of structures of power that are in place and unchanging. And for me, it was also pleasurable to shift that meaning or that location that these men are afforded into some other. But as I mentioned, it's ethically dubious also in how I do it, because I realize that I don't attend to something about what face markings mean for many people as being sacred or holy. But I think we should still do works that are not perfect.
Any comments or questions to Noash Kamal? So okay, then one last one then from my side. Concerning laughter.
Oh, yeah.
Exactly that kind of laughter. So I wonder, because you mentioned it also in relation to the response that at least the later part of the portraits that you received, and I'm just wondering whether you could share some more observations in relation to the... It's also like one of the... a very intriguing talk that Rosalind Morris gave here 2 weeks ago in relation to lips and the whole question of laughter, laughing, humor, humor versus terror, the liberating versus the sort of conservative function of laughter. I wonder if you have thoughts on this.
Like everything, I have a million thoughts on this. The very first college artist class I taught was on the grotesque and laughter and contemporary art, grotesque and humor, grotesque body. And for me, laughter, there's this, gets situated for me in terms of Mikhail Bakhtin. He talks about medieval laughter and carnival laughter as being able to laugh in the face of death. And so this kind of laughter is liberatory laughter. And for me, this is a key to talking about very difficult histories, very painful histories that one doesn't want to look at. And it also makes it possible for me to work with this material. I think laughter is cathartic. It's necessary, but it also implicates you as the viewer into something you might not want to be implicated in because you're laughing. You've made that leap or that connection into, and so, and then, I think of it as a kind of cathartic thing and a space. I think laughter is really necessary.
You want to ask a question? I have to give you the mic.
Yeah, well, racism didn't stop at the borders of the empires or the colonies because it's also racialized Europe too. So I wondered if you used any of these materials where Europe was Europeans racialized themselves, because you said it's about othering the white man, and the Bergman did other himself all the time with whiteness of a different color, with all these tribal ethnicizations, and they used exactly the same kinds of visual regimes for doing that in Europe, about Europe. So that's one question, maybe. The other thing is facial markings, of course. I mean, these white people did have facial markings, because especially maybe even somebody like Pöchel and so on, they had, of course, the Schmisser of the... So there was a facial marking in Europe that they used for bloodletting and scarification. So it was in Germany, right? Especially in German-speaking countries. So it's it was as exotic as it could get, as an initiation rite of students, basically, and this whole century. So Franz Boas, for example, was heavily scarified. So yeah.
I'm not sure that I caught what the first question was about. Then I'm not aware of this. I mean, what I am aware of is like this thing, this kind of club and history of, for instance, in the GDR, this where white Germans would dress up as Native Americans and then photograph themselves in their kind of make-believe ceremonies, and they would make their own headdresses and costumes, and it still exists, but it's apparently dying out. It's only old people that are doing it now. So I'm aware of this kind of thing, but I'm not sure of, in photography, the self racialization. I'm not sure I understand the question. Yeah, okay.
Okay, thanks a lot.